Welcome to another episode of Sharing the Hope from the Micah Mason Foundation. I'm your host, Patrick Mason, and I am joined today by Dr. Lopez, Dr. Kayla N. Lopez, a native of Chicago, is an associate professor of pediatrics in the section of pediatric cardiology at Texas Children's Hospital and Baylor College of Medicine. She completed her medical school at Rush Medical College in Chicago, Illinois, and then completed her residency in pediatrics at the University of Chicago. She subsequently completed the Commonwealth Fund Fellowship at Harvard School of Public Health in Minority Health Policy and Healthcare Management in Boston, Massachusetts. She completed her medical training by completing a fellowship in pediatric cardiology with a focus on cardiovascular imaging at Baylor College of Medicine, Texas Children's Hospital in Houston, Texas, where she now resides. Dr. Lopez seeks to incorporate cardiology, public health, and minority health policy in order to develop research initiatives that directly inform health policy and improve the health care of minorities and underserved populations. She hopes to identify strategies to enhance and prolong the lives of those with CHD through surveillance, population-based research, education, health promotion, advocacy, and policy development. So welcome to the show, Dr. Lopez.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. So is there anything I left out that you wanted to mention?
I mean, I think it's very clear that I'm from Chicago. That's really one of the most important things that people know about me. So no, I think we're good.
Okay, good deal. So what got you interested in the congenital heart disease problem?
So I knew, you know, there's two types of people. Well, actually, in medicine, it's either medical or surgical. And once I decided I was not a surgical person, I knew it was medical. But then there's adults or kids. And what I found was that the kids were far more honest with me, far more direct. And that's much more my personality. And so I really appreciated the kids. And so I knew I wanted to do pediatrics. And I also knew that I wanted to do something on a bigger scale, but I couldn't quite put my finger on that. I couldn't figure out what exactly that meant, but I just knew that I wanted to impact the lives of more people if I could. And so once I went to residency, I started kind of trying to figure out which was a subspecialty I liked the best. And I learned about myself that I'm somebody who likes to know a lot about one area as opposed to a little bit about a lot of areas. And that's kind of part of how I decided to subspecialize. And then one day I encountered a patient in their cardiac ICU who had a very complicated congenital heart disease. And the doctor that was the pediatric cardiologist that was on explained to me what was happening. And I was like, it was the first time it was so clear. I'm like, oh, so if you follow the blood flow, you can figure this out. And then you can do something about it. That's amazing. And so many diseases we couldn't do anything about, but this one we could. And so I was intrigued. And then the more kids that I met with congenital heart disease and the more that I learned about it in terms of it being the number one birth defect, that it's far more common than people realize. The more I became intrigued with the entire area. It kind of took a left-hand turn when I ended up doing a year of public health. I fell in love with public health. That was kind of the way that I knew I could impact more people globally speaking. I just didn't know how to translate that into congenital heart disease. And in fact, I was told several times that I could not, that if I wanted to do a subspecialty field, I could not then do public health unless I wanted to focus on like sodas in schools or something, because it's very public healthy or, you know, clean water. And so when I brought this up to my very, very brilliant program director, Dr. Steve Nish at Texas Children's, I said, you know, we have a problem. I am really in love with public health and I like pediatric cardiology a lot, but I'm in love with public health. So now what do we do? And he said, you know what? We can do both. You can do both. We need people to do public health in congenital heart disease. We need people to work on disparities and outcomes. He was the first person to give me permission to do this. So I'm very, very grateful to him. But, you know, and then from then on, you know, the further that things went along, the more public health became a thing in congenital heart disease. It used to not be a thing at all. But obviously with something like pulse oximetry screening, it's very clear that public health initiatives in pediatric cardiology can be very effective and can really work to help reduce inequitable outcomes.
I'll agree. I think when I first came into the world, congenital heart defects, it wasn't something anybody was talking about. And I want to say, I don't know whether a lot of studies came out in the 2020, 2021 timeframe, or if people just started paying attention to them, but it suddenly became a big deal. in a lot of the organizations I was following, which is a good thing because, you know, ultimately we would want people to get the treatment that they need. Doesn't really matter who you are, where you're from. It matters what you need. So talk to us a little bit about healthcare inequity and public health and kind of what you're doing.
They say that when you're trying to decide what you want to do in a field, you should decide the type of talk that you want to give in 5 years at a national meeting. That was the advice that I was given.
And that's, so good, I thought, that's really good advice. I never thought about it that way. But it is. Yeah,
so they
yeah,
said,
yeah.
What's the talk you want to be giving in 5 years? And what meeting do you want to be giving it at? And I thought, well, that's an interesting question. And so I thought long and hard about it. And I thought, you know, I don't want to be kind of pigeonholed into the just one little teeny area, because my initial interest was, in fact, transitions of care. So we were doing, this is still a very big issue. We were doing very, very poorly in retaining patients in care in congenital heart disease. So we would pour in all these resources to this patient population early on, you know, when they're first born, when they first have these diagnoses, have initial surgeries, then they would get older and be lost to follow up because people would say, oh, they're cured, or, you know, we're done taking care of them, or they become adults and say, oh, I just need to see an adult cardiologist. Well, none of that is actually true. And so I took an interest in that area because that was one of the most egregious disparities that I was noticing in our field, was that the resource used on the front end and then the lack thereof on the back end when they become adults. I'm like, well, this is not great. And so I started working in that area initially as a way to kind of impact poor outcomes, especially as patients age in the teenage years and early adulthood. And then I realized, as I was thinking about the talk that I wanted to give, you know, in 5 years, I realized that I really wanted to be able to impact any aspect of congenital heart disease as it pertained to inequitable outcomes. So that goes from how many patients are or are not being prenatally diagnosed, and what's the demographics of that population, you know, and we did a study looking at that. And we found that patients who live in rural areas, patients who are Latino or who don't speak as much English and who have a lower socioeconomic status, that are the least likely to be diagnosed prenatally or the most likely to have a late prenatal diagnosis, which of course can impact care. Mm-hmm. And so that's on the front end. Then you kind of go throughout outcomes in terms of what types of surgeries people have and what's the mortality, who's getting referred to which hospital, high mortality hospitals versus low mortality hospitals, and why is there a difference between who's getting referred where? A lot of patients who have a lower health literacy don't know where to look. They don't know that there's a difference between centers and which centers are preeminent centers that do congenital heart disease surgery and which ones are not. They just kind of go with whatever their doctor said or whoever's affiliated with the birth hospital. And then if you keep moving it forward, then you say, oh, okay, mental health is an issue. There's a big disparity there as it pertains in our field. We didn't used to recognize it for the longest time. Then of course, neurodevelopment and differential outcomes in neurodevelopment became a thing. And then transition, as I already discussed, and then adult congenital care. If you fast forward to adult congenital care, where patients are getting treated by doctors who have never had any formal training in congenital heart disease whatsoever. So this is an astounding fact for you. Do you happen to know what is the requirement for an adult cardiologist to have in terms of training in adult congenital heart disease or in congenital heart disease in general? What is the formal requirement?
I would kind of assume there isn't one yet, but I don't know.
So formally, they are recommended to have 6 hours of lecture. The end. So this is a problem. This is a problem.
I'm laughing because of how sad that is.
It's very sad. Do you happen to know how many adult congenital physicians that are board certified that exist in the United States today?
I don't know. No.
About 483. We have a math problem.
I was going to say that's because it's like we're over 1.2 million adults with CHD, right?
Yes, and we're adding over 40,000 per year as they age, right? Yeah. And so you can imagine then if you're going to take a layered approach and you're like, okay, so first we're talking about people who have a shorter lifespan in general because of depending on the severity of their congenital heart disease. And if you layer on top of that, someone who has poor social determinants of health, which are kind of the things that most inform health outcomes. They say that 80% of health outcomes are actually directly related to your social determinants, which is where you work, live, are born, eat, go to school, go to church, etc. So if you layer poor people who have poor access to high quality food or high quality healthcare, and then you layer on top of that lack of ACHD care and then poor mental health, well, we have a big problem. We have a lot of inequities happening in our field across the lifespan. And so ultimately, I knew that my role then was to be the person who brings to light inequities in various aspects of care or outcomes, or somebody who develops interventions that says, okay, how can we make this better? And work with various fields and say, oh, hey, actually, they already did this in cystic fibrosis. Can we learn from them? They've already done this in diabetes. Can we learn from them? Other chronic diseases that affect children. And so that ultimately became my mission then, was to be the health disparities person, if you will, in terms of helping institutions achieve more equitable outcomes and further patients, and then having, you know, empowering patients to learn more about what their rights are for their kids to have the best outcomes. And now, as a person who's a policy trained person in public health, I really want to move into more of a policy space where we say the people who are making decisions upstream about how we can deliver care downstream, that makes a big difference in how we're able to have equitable outcomes in care. And so many of the laws that are passed or budgets that are, you know, set aside for children or for congenital heart disease make a big difference in how we're able to deliver care. And that's the area that I think I'm kind of eventually moving into, or moving more towards now, as someone who's been in the field for a little while.
Good. So you're at Texas Children's Hospital System. Are you part of any other of the, you know, many cardiac organizations, and are you doing work with any of them?
Yes. So I've been a member of various parent-patient organizations. I've worked with Mended Little Hearts at some point. I've worked with Conquering CHD at some point, still do, as an advisor. I'm chairing a committee for the American Heart Association. I'm on the advocacy committee for the American College of Cardiology for the Adult Congenital and Pediatric Cardiology subsection. I work with the American Academy of Pediatrics in their advocacy wing. There's a lot of adjacent areas that have to do with congenital heart disease that I work in, or that I work alongside as it pertains to CHD. So it's been a very rewarding thing, because when you get to meet other people that are doing the same, you know, similar work in various institutions, it's very cool. It's very exciting to see other people in this space who are really excited about moving the needle forward, instead of saying, hey, did you know that patients who have worse social determinants have worse outcomes? And thank you very much. Like that's where we were. Now we're moving towards, what do we do now? What can work now? And a lot of that has to do with, what are the ways that we can deliver equitable care? And so all those organizations that I mentioned are really also focusing more, much, much more, way more on this space, which is great, and bringing in people to the space and having different groups or committees that are more focused on this space. And in fact, the reason we were able to publish a American Heart Association scientific statement on mitigating unequal social determinants of health in congenital heart disease was because I happened to be on that committee, and I brought that up as an idea, and people were excited and willing to listen. The tide is turning in terms of these advocacy groups, and in terms of, you know, parent organizations like the AHA or the ACC or the AAP for that matter, where they're now, people are now talking much more about equitable outcomes or the lack thereof, and what can we do as a field to move this forward, because it's been recognized that there's a problem here, as we discuss across the lifespan. That was one other paper, just to mention, since we're talking about, I know there's things like based in research. There was a paper that I worked on with some brilliant colleagues and an epidemiologist who, by the way, if you don't have any epidemiological friends, please make some, because they're really brilliant people, but they really help a lot with research. But Dr. Jason Salemi was the gentleman that I worked with. He's a brilliant epidemiologist who happens to work a lot in birth defects. And we published a paper looking at disparities in mortality across the lifespan in congenital heart disease from birth until the age of 35. And we looked at it between the years of 1999 and 2017. And what we found is that while mortality in congenital heart disease as a whole has been decreasing, there was still a significant gap in mortality, meaning there was more deaths if you were a non-Hispanic Black than if you were non-Hispanic White. And then for Hispanics, they originally had a graphic that looked very similar to the non-Hispanic Whites, except that their mortality rates plateaued and the Whites continued to drop. And so that publication really was kind of a big in-your-face eye-opener, because we had that data. The earlier publication, I think, went to 2006 or something. Mm-hmm. They could, that same area, earlier publications, we thought, well, things must have gotten better by now. And then to see that it actually hasn't is really challenging to see. And it makes us go, something is wrong here and we need to do better in all the spaces. Cause this is from, again, prenatal care, you know, infancy to at least the age of 35. And again, that was a publication with one of the AHA journals of circulation. So there is a lot of interest in this area now. There has been in adult spaces for a long time. Mm-hmm. Now we are finally getting the memo over here on the pediatric side, which is great.
Yeah. I remember attending a research reception with the Children's Heart Foundation where they presented that data. And then going to one of the, well, it was a learning session, NPC, QIC, Fontan Outcomes Network learning session, where they presented sort of their subset, you know, that Children's Heart Foundation was presenting all of congenital heart defects, and then NPC, QIC, Fawn was presenting HLHS or single ventricle specific. And that, you know, it was a mirror data. And I kind of imagine a lot of the congenital heart defect data is single ventricle because it's one of those non-cured ones. It's something that somebody's going to live with. And so the whole transition process and everything is very important.
And then, those groups, if you're talking about people making strides in congenital heart disease from a research perspective and from an equity perspective, NPC, QIC, FON, PAC 3, which is acute care cardiology, PC4, which is critical care cardiology, Cardiac Networks United, which kind of takes everybody together. These are all quality collaborative, CCRC, which is a cath-based one, the Fetal Heart Society. So these are all groups within pediatric cardiology that have gotten together and said, hey, listen, we don't have enough numbers at any one institution. If we can maybe get together and, you know, in our spaces and work together, maybe we could do something that has a broader impact in terms of informing us regarding outcomes, be they clinical, health equity, or otherwise, parent communication, all this stuff. And so these groups are actually doing a lot of the heavy lifting on pushing the health equity needle and saying, hey, you know, these are initiatives we want to move forward in fetal or in HLHS or in critical care sedation practices, whatever it is, they get to, again, to emphasize equity in the various subspecialty spaces within pediatric cardiology. So kudos to those groups because they have done a very good job of pushing forward the equity needle and promoting health equity within these smaller spaces within pediatric cardiology. That's also true for ISHLT, the transplant group.
Okay.
So there's several groups that have been working within their subspecialty to push equity as a concept and equity interventions too.
I'll call back to an earlier episode in case people want to listen to it, but we interviewed Dr. Chaitis Chan out of Seattle Children's. He's one of the guys in charge of NPCQIC's health equity. I want to say it's a level 2 initiative, or might be. So I'm excited to see. I got to see the presentation last year and then interview him, and then I'm excited to see what it's going to look like this year, what they've done. So,
yeah. Well, how awesome are the people in California who are able to use their databases that are available to them to look at outcomes as they pertain to access to care from insurance perspective? Or there's another brilliant pediatric cardiologist by the name of Shabnam Pivandi, and she is doing work looking at neurodevelopmental outcomes, but she's also doing work looking at how much of one's outcome is explained by what people used to think. People used to think that people's outcomes were directly related to their race and saying, oh, this is some biological thing. But her work has informed a lot of the social determinants as mediators, the things that mediate the outcome between race and whatever the outcome is. And she's done publications showing that race accounts for a much smaller percentage than maternal education or insurance status for these poorer outcomes. Dispelling what we used to think is biology, and now we realize is much more having to do with the social determinants. And Titus Chan has done a lot of this work too. So those guys in California are doing awesome work.
Yeah.
It's really cool to see the stuff that they do and how they leverage large databases to show some of these outcomes or the differential outcomes.
I am very grateful for all the work going on, having a son who's, you know, 7 and who's going to be hopefully partaking of all the advancements that come along as he grows. Always grateful for all the work going on. Let me ask you about your connection to the Children's Heart Foundation.
So with the Children's Heart Foundation, I have worked alongside several members of the Children's Heart Foundation in various spaces. There's lots of pediatric cardiologists, obviously, working alongside that group. And many of us have worked in other spaces together, including the Pediatric Heart Network, you know, which is the arm of the NIH, the National Institutes of Health. They mm-hmm. have a Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. And so the Pediatric Heart Network is kind of the subset of that, that focuses on congenital heart disease. So a lot of the individuals that I've met at the Children's Heart Foundation have been through those other circles, or NPC-QIC, or FUN, or all of the above, right? So, you know, I know a lot of them in these spaces. And so for several of them, many of them heard me present data or presentations in general on inequities in congenital heart disease outcomes. And then, you know, thought more about their own focus and thought more about their own priorities as an organization and said, hey, can you help us inform more how to have more equitable outcomes as it pertains to research or grants and things like this? And so I became involved in their medical advisory board, medical advisory committee, formally, I think it was in January, I believe it was. And there are some pretty brilliant people on there. And it's pretty cool to see a lot of these grants that will come through and the focuses and the kind of, you know, pediatric cardiologists are very creative people. You have to be very creative to come up with some of these treatments that we have or surgeries that we have and as our cardiothoracic surgeons. And so to see some of the stuff that people are putting forward and see that much of that has to do with equitable care or focusing on ways to make things more equitable. Now that's much more obvious in the language of the grant funding. And that's to the credit of CHF, because they've made it a point to say, hey, we have to do what we can to be able to have more equity in the grant funding that we're doing and more equity in terms of the types of projects that we're funding, instead of just being in the ICU or something. Now, you know, what happens when someone leaves, for example. And so that's my involvement. Lots of crossover with people in other spaces and then being able to work with them in this space, which is pretty cool. There's lots of brilliant people that work for CHF. So I feel pretty lucky.
Good deal. That's part of our Micah Mason Foundation's partnership with CHF. We have a name fund in Micah's name. And so you guys, because you're on the medical advisory board, you're providing a function that then we don't have to. you guys can review it as doctors and scientists and researchers and figure out which are the best projects to go after, and we can just, you know, fund it.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you bring that up as you as a funder, because what we have learned, I mean, there's data to show this, is that sometimes what we as physicians and scientists think this is where we should invest our time, our resources, our funding, our research, when we actually do the crazy work of speaking with patients, when we actually say, hey, what do you think? You're the one who's living with a child with congenital heart disease. What are your thoughts? Or you're living with it yourself. Oftentimes, what we thought was important and what the patients thought were important did not align. So that was a harsh reality for us to figure out. And so now, many times, we actually have input from parents, from people who run organizations that are parent-led, that help us inform not only what are we going to fund or what is a priority, but also there is a perspective to be gained from parent participation or patient-centered outcomes research, where the patients inform us of a lot of the things that we think that we know or that we assume that we knew. And suddenly you get the perspective of a patient, and then you change your care delivery, or you change your research model, or you change your intervention profoundly. Because without partnerships with parents and or patients in this space, we're at best guessing what we think is a good idea, especially when it pertains to interventions. So if you don't have input from these key stakeholders, being parents and patients, then in research in general, then we are doing a gross disservice to the field, because we can assume a lot, but unless you are living it, unless you are living the experience of being a parent who has a child with congenital heart disease, or being a person with congenital heart disease yourself, then you really don't know what that feels like. And you can't. You can know what it feels like to treat them, but you cannot know, in fact, what it feels like to be them. And so this next phase of research funding, of research prioritization, of interventions, it's going to be actually critical that these partnerships move forward in a real way, not just like, we got his 5 cents of an idea. That's cool. But in a real way where patients help figure out what is the intervention, where they help in the design, they help in the delivery, and they help in the dissemination of these efforts. Because without that, I'm not really sure what we're doing. Like I said, for a long time, we thought that we knew better. And it turns out that that was wrong. We're learning a lot. You'll notice I say a lot. Like, well, we were wrong. So the good news is, I mean, it's an evolving thing. That's science, right? It evolves. And there's a whole reason why there is a grant funding mechanism called PCORI, where the entire thing, which is a patient-centered outcomes research institute, which is the whole thing is based in you partnering with patients and parents to develop interventions or research strategies or initiatives that are directly resultant of discussions with that, with the group that's being affected, which is frankly how it should be. They should be involved in research design. One other thing I'll say about equity, it is also critically important at this phase, at this stage where we are, that people who are delivering care and people who are running research projects or who are developing them, that there is a direct link between those researchers, those providers, and the communities that they're serving. If the individuals that are doing that work look nothing like those communities that they are researching, there is a disconnect because those patients in those communities may not feel comfortable participating because nobody in the research team looks like them, or nobody in the research team speaks their language, or culturally they're afraid because there's a history of experimentation on certain populations in this country. There's a longstanding history that medical mistreatment in this country. And so as we move forward, this is part of the reason why having those voices is so critically important to partner with, but also why who is delivering the research and who is delivering the care and who is going into these communities and partnering with these with communities that are traditionally underserved or who have worse outcomes, that the researchers and the people who are developing the research have individuals who look like the community or who speak the same language or who are from the same culture, because that engenders trust. And trust is critical when we're talking about research.
Yeah. I remember discussing that with some nurses because they were talking about the same problem about not being able to get as many parents from their local community involved. And I said, well, a lot of it has to do with like who's at the center. I remember where we were at in Fort Worth at Cook Children's. You know, I'm Caucasian and I was a minority. And there's a very different feel to being in that setting than there is to when, you know, there's lots of folks who look like you around. And so as a parent, the likelihood of volunteering, of helping, of being on an advisory board, of volunteering at the hospital, of joining organizations like FON or NPC or, you know, the Children's Heart Foundation are somewhat reliant on those social factors. If I'm going to join another tribe, I need to know that the tribe is going to accept me. And right. One of the key factors of that is acknowledging, are they like me? And how are they like me? And is that easily recognizable?
Mm-hmm.
Very good point. So going back to sort of the beginning, what speech do you want to give 5 years from now? What's kind of your hope to be able to talk to the
you
national
convention? Oh, wow, that back on me.
Convention.
Okay. All right. You know, it would be great if 5 years from now, the talks that I would be giving would be talking about how certain interventions are working or not working, or what are the interventions that are working and how are we disseminating those interventions. We're still in the phase of speaking about describing things. We're still a lot of describing happening here. Talking about the actual interventions and outcomes would be really helpful. That would be a great talk to be giving. And then furthermore, how we as a community, as a congenital heart disease community, are able to partner or break into this advocacy space beyond advocating with each other, meaning like at the state and federal level and doing work that says, hey, what bills can we, you know, work with you on at the federal and state levels to be able to provide funding? Say, for example, when someone is becoming an adult with congenital heart disease and they fall off of their public insurance at the age of 18 in certain states, what can we do for that population? How are they going to access care? And what are the bills that we can promote to be able to have a safety net for this very high-risk population, or have a group that's taking care of them? Or what policies can we put into place to say, hey, we spent gazillions of dollars on the front end. It seems silly to just be like, good luck to you on the back end, you know? Right. And what can we do from a policy perspective, again, at these local, state, federal levels with passage of bills and things to make a real impact? Those are the types of things I'd like to talk about, kind of more upstream factors to be able to deliver better downstream care. We can do all we want, but without funding and without real investment, it's going to be very challenging for us to deliver the high quality care across the board to all individuals in this space.
I hope to be able to hear the talk.
That would be neat. I'd be like, I know that guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Patrick in the crowd.
Yeah, yeah. I'll probably have less hair. I think I'm going to get a haircut. It's getting a little crazy, but okay. So this is a question I tend to ask at the end. It's a little bit of a curveball. It comes from the place where the idea behind this podcast comes from. I'm on a lot of the Facebook sort of groups for single ventricle patients and parents. And inevitably, on a routine basis, we have a parent pop up who has just been, just gotten the diagnosis. And they're terrified. And their cardiologist that they saw maybe hasn't really kept up with the literature on what's going on and basically told them pretty much it's all bad news. What would you say to somebody who came to you in that state?
You know, what you just described sounds like Tuesday. I mean, this still happens all the time in this space, to your point. You know, I think it's important, and I guess it depends on when this patient came, if it came as a prenatal diagnosis or if it came as a postnatal diagnosis that was a surprise, because those people are kind of in different emotional places at yes. that time. But yeah. I think it depends. Some of what someone needs to hear at a certain moment isn't necessarily like all of the data per se. So I think as a field, we are learning, what does it mean to meet someone where they're at? Because when you get a diagnosis that is this profound, to be going into doctor mode and start like throwing out all the statistics that you know and all of the latest and greatest data isn't always necessarily helpful, it turns out, because people don't actually comprehend much of that because they're so kind of in a state of shock about what's happening.
Yeah.
And so we are trying to learn ways to meet patients where they're at from an emotional perspective, but also from a health literacy perspective. Not everybody has learned how to read medical literature. I mean, most of the time, by the time you guys have gone through this, you actually, you know, might as well have a doctorate because you're sitting there on rounds all day and you're talking about, you know, all of these crazy, like, oh, the bicarb and, you know, all these other things on rounds that you're used to hearing it.
Yeah.
But in the beginning, it's very overwhelming. So I think the role that we probably should start playing is determining where somebody is at that moment. Like, what is somebody able to grasp at that moment? And then, you know, circling back, doing something crazy, like circling back and saying, hey, I know that this is a moment for you. I'm going to give you a little bit of time and I'll follow up with you tomorrow. So instead of just being like, well, this is the time that I had for today and just throwing out all the stuff that you know. We know a lot of stuff. We know a lot of facts. Not everyone, as you said, is as up to date with the data as other people. But it's probably best to kind of gauge someone where they're at, give them some time, give them some data, then some time, then circle back again. We do that a lot in the prenatal space where we will give some information and say, I will see you again in 4 weeks and we will go over this again so that someone has time to kind of process. The other thing that I tell patients in that state where they have maybe not received the best information or they've received limited information or everything's a shock is I say, please, 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 please be careful with Dr. Google. Because it is a very dangerous place.
Yeah, you're not the only one to give this advice.
It's a very dangerous place. There, you know, not all, I mean, our lesions are very, very heterogeneous. And so not all the lesions are created equal. And then beyond that, we focus so much, you know, in terms of other than just giving data, we focus so much on the patient, which is very good. But there are two people involved here often. There is the parent and the patient. We often forget about the parents. I mean, there is data coming out now about how parents are experiencing legit PTSD, like legit.
Oh, yeah.
Where they don't, they're unable, they're having flashbacks and it's very scary. Or where we're not checking in, like, how are you actually doing? Like, have you been okay since you've not been able to work for 2 months? You know, like we don't do this level of assessment always. Sometimes, depending on where you are, depending on how resourced the setting is, they have social workers who kind of can do these things, but that's not true everywhere. And so the advice that I would give would be, other than know Dr. Google, is making sure that we meet the patient where they're at, understanding what their health literacy is, understanding what their mental health currently is, and then figuring out how much information someone can digest at a certain moment, because it's a lot. It's a lot for a pediatrician, let alone a parent. Like, a pediatrician who's not a cardiologist is like, what? When we talk about congenital heart disease,
yeah,
you know, we only get 1 month of training in pediatrics for congenital heart disease. And so it's limited. So even someone who's a fully trained pediatrician has a hard time understanding some of these concepts, let alone someone who has no medical training at all. So I think that that combination of, you know, what would you do with that person? Well, I think you need to meet with them where they're at. You need to assess kind of their mental state. You need to assess their health literacy. And then you need to work with them to be able to help bring them along in a way that is informative and inclusive, but also doesn't really just meet you where you're at, which is to just regurgitate all this data. And then the person just standing there like, what did you just say? I have no idea what just happened. That's probably not the right way to do it. It's also not great to give no data. That's also not, or gloom and doom data. That's also not great. But, you know, snippets, one day at a time. I mean, I don't have to tell you, CHD is one day at a time often. Yeah. So when the prenatal space, we'll get questions like, will my child be able to play college football? when the patient is pregnant with this person. And so we try to say like, hey, listen, this is the long haul game. And we have to kind of take a day at a time because it's hard for us to predict. But there are very, you know, we always talk about there's some light here, because every day, I mean, this is the thing about congenital heart disease. Every day people are coming up with creative new ideas to improve care. Every day researchers are doing this. And so it's actually a very exciting time in our field. We have moved beyond just surgery. So it's a very, very exciting time from a parent and patient perspective, because we are realizing so much more about what it means to be a patient with congenital heart disease and what's next, or what are things that we can do to help? How can we help with school? How can we help with job planning? Oh, hey, did you know that you can also have a baby? You know, this kind of stuff. Like, there's several things that we can do to not be gloom and doom, but a metered approach is probably best.
Very good. Good answer. I like it.
Well, thank you.
So you hit the curveball. Okay. Final question. So you're in the Houston area. Which part of Houston?
Well, I'm near the Met Center. So the Met Center is kind of like its own downtown. It's so big.
Yep.
So there's downtown Houston and then there's the Met Center Houston. So
yeah. Houston is one of those, because I live in Dallas. We travel to Houston pretty frequently. And Houston's one of those cities where you can be standing on the street and you can look up at the skyline and think to yourself, I'm not in downtown.
Yeah.
And I've got all these giant buildings around me, but I'm not downtown.
Well, they joke around that everything's bigger in Texas. And I thought it was a joke until I got here. And I was like, in fact, I think it's true. You know, largest medical center in the country is here. It's crazy.
Yeah. And one of the best. Texas Children's is an amazing hospital. So the final question is, if I find myself in that area, where do I need to go eat?
Oh. Oh, gosh. Okay. I mean, it really kind of depends on what you like. I will say that people talk about like, oh, there's great Mexican food in Houston. I would say, as a person whose dad is, in fact, Mexican, I would say that there is great Tex-Mex food in Houston.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's excellent Tex-Mex food here. There is one place that I think is fantastic that is not shishi or fancy or anything, but it is a place called 100% Taquito. And it's very authentic Mexican food and it's very good and it's very affordable. So that's one great place off the top of my head. The other ones are, there's some very good Mexican food that is not the Tex-Mex you usually hear about from famous chefs that are from Mexico now that have placed roots here.
Oh,
so there's a place called Sochi. There's a place called Sochi that focuses on food from Oaxaca.
Okay.
That's near downtown. That's very good. And then there's another place called Cuchara. Cuchara is a Mexican food place that focuses on food from Mexico City. And those are a little more upscale compared to 100% Taquito, but they all focus on Mexican cuisine, like legit Mexican cuisine. They're all excellent. So, you know, I grew up eating a lot of Mexican food and I love it. But I can tell you, it is absolutely not the same as Tex-Mex.
No.
So if you're coming to Houston, and you desire real Mexican food, those are the places that I would go. Mexican food, some of the best food in Houston anyway, or Tex-Mex for that matter.
Yeah, I like to, you know, there's always this argument between Californians and Texas on who has the best Mexicans. Like, it's not, like, it's Tex-Mex in Texas and it's Cali-Mex in California, and neither of them are Mexican. Like,
that's exactly right. Like, no, this is actually Mex-Mex. Yeah. Yes, that's exactly right. They're very good. It's just different.
Yeah.
It's just different. But I mean, I brought my dad to, my dad's the one who's Mexican, to Cuchara for his birthday when he was here. He was very impressed.
Oh, good.
Because they, you know, they have mole. Mole is like the kind of traditional sauce.
Yeah.
I mean, and when you do it right and you put the, you know, the average mole takes like 26 ingredients at a minimum. And so when you do it right, it can be amazing. Yeah. So for the record.
Good. I'm probably going to be personally taking up those recommendations at least the next
week. Yeah, so you're right. I'll get an email from you next week being like, it was great.
Yeah. It was awesome. I want to thank you very much both for joining us today on the podcast and for the work you do. I think it's very important work, and I really appreciate the work you do. So thank you very much, Dr. Lopez, for joining us.
Thank you so much for the time and for your family investing and funding CHD research. That's so important, and it's so cool when families get involved this way if they can. So thank you for your contribution as well.
Thank you, dear listener, for joining us for another episode of Sharing the Hope from the Mike and Mason Foundation. I'm your host, Patrick Mason, and thank you for joining us for our conversation with Dr. Kayla Lopez. If you'd like to support the podcast, head to themikeandmasonfoundation.org or mikeandmasonfoundation.org and click on the donate button. Thank you.